birthday to Juan Gonzalez and Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org. It's where community grows.
This is Miniculture on KFAI. 200 years ago, an Italian aristocrat traveled to the North Woods of present-day Minnesota in an attempt to make a name for himself. He wanted to become famous by discovering the source of the Mississippi River. KFAI's John Gwynn tells this story of Giacomo Beltrami and his incongruous journey during the summer of 1823.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river. Well, you're not actually in the boat. You're walking in the river, pulling the boat with a tow rope. You tried paddling the birch bark canoe, but you couldn't keep it straight, zigzagging back and forth, not making any progress. You had watched some Ojibwe guides masterfully pilot them, but for you, it's not working. You roll up your trousers and get out, towing your canoe with your belongings inside. Fine leather cases, Italian silk bags, and a big red umbrella drying out from the storm the night before. This is where Giacomo Constantino Beltrami found himself in 1823, trudging along the Robbers River in what is now far northern Minnesota. Beltrami, from the town of Bergamo, was maybe the first Italian nomad ever to wander these lands. He was wet, cold, tired and hungry, but not miserable, for he was on a quest. Beltrami had sailed across the Atlantic from Liverpool, then took a steamship up the Ohio River. As he prepared to board another ship heading south to New Orleans, he unexpectedly met a fellow paisan, an Italian-American named Lawrence Taliaferro, who was the Indian agent at the new United States military outpost called Fort St. Anthony, appointed by the government to oversee the tribes. So, in May 1823, Beltrami, instead of going south, climbed aboard the Virginia, the first steamship to travel so far up the Mississippi River. He was a 44-year-old Italian aristocrat with a quick temper, dressed in silken scarves and fancy shoes. Like many Europeans, he exoticized indigenous people and wanted to study their way of life. The fort was being built at the confluence of the Mississippi and the Minnesota, which the Europeans called the St. Peter River, and housed some soldiers, a few dozen settlers, and many traders, meaning people trying to make a buck cheating the natives to sell beaver pelts to the Astors back in New York City. Josiah and Mary Snelling received Giacomo warmly and invited him over to the house in Mendota for dinner. He asked to stay at the fort for a couple of months, while planning his quest. Beltrami kept a journal and sent letters back home to his close friend Giulia de' Medici. He described his newfound mission. "It is my intention to proceed thence to the sources of the Mississippi, which are still absolutely unknown." Fortuitously enough, Major Stephen Long, an army engineer, arrived at the fort. He was leading a surveying party to chart the St. Peter River. Beltrami insisted on being given a spot, but Major Long refused, being a Yankee and a military man and not that appreciative of the loose-lipped informality of the Italian wanderer. Snelling and Taliaferro lobbied Major Long into including him as part of the expedition. Perhaps after a couple of months, they would gain some relief not having to listen to him every day. Long finally acquiesced, and Beltrami loaded his Italian luggage and umbrellas into a canoe ready to depart. The party tracked west to Lake Traverse and then down the Red River to the 49th parallel, which Congress was eager to establish as the border between British and American-held land. During the trip, the major kept Beltrami at a distance, rarely discussing anything about the survey readings or current location. Beltrami was unhappy about being excluded, writing in his journal, "It would be very interesting to know whereabout we are with relation to the North Pole, but the major conceals this from me with more care than the priests of Tibet conceal their Grand Lama." In early August, Major Long wrote in his journal, "Mr. Beltrami, our Italian companion, left the party in a very hasty and angry manner." Beltrami followed a couple of Ojibwe men passing by at the time, paddling down Robbers River, heading southeast. He was pursuing his quest to discover the source of the Father of Waters, the Mississippi River. On a hot summer day in August, fighting through the brambles and overgrowth, Giacomo and his guides traveled east in the late afternoon across a beautifully still, heart-shaped lake about 3 miles in circumference. Clambering up a hill, they surveyed the surrounding lands. "This must be it. The source," Beltrami thought triumphantly. He wrote to his beloved Giulia de' Medici back in Lombardy. "Oh, what were the thoughts that passed through my mind at this most happy and brilliant moment of my life?" And this is where we find you, Giacomo Beltrami, wading through the river in your canoe. You continue east into Leech Lake, and then down the Mississippi, back toward Fort St. Anthony. According to your own accounts, some Midewankaton Dakota scouts are hiding behind the trees along the ridge. Instinctively, you unfurl your fine and beautiful red Italian umbrella as a message to any would-be attackers that you should be allowed to pass as a neutral party, for you are just an Italian wanderer, far from home. It works, and you are given safe passage, perhaps due to your eccentricity and flashy Italian accessories. That was the last of Giacomo Beltrami in these lands. He was here for only a few months. Unfortunately, his proudest accomplishment was all for naught. Despite Beltrami's reverie on that hilltop near Bemidji on August 31st, 1823, his geographical deductions were quite untrue. He was off by 50 miles, the Mississippi's actual source being further south and to the west. The lake that he claimed was the source, Lake Giulia, named for his beloved Italian friend Giulia de' Medici, sits alongside the current township of Poposki, which is quite a bad translation for an Ojibwe word meaning shaky ground, which is how we might describe the erroneous claims of Giacomo Beltrami.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. This episode was edited by Mason Butler. Support for Miniculture on KFAI has been provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or visit kfai.org/MINNECULTURE.
Good afternoon and welcome to Miniculture Presents, found here on your radio dial every Monday afternoon at 1. My name is Michael Whetstone. I'm very glad to be with you. Today, we are going to hear the Miniculture's very own podcast, now in their 7th season. You can subscribe to the Miniculture podcast wherever you like to download such things. It's all over the place, but you can also find it on KFAI.org, and you can find everything Miniculture puts out on their SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. I urge you to give all their seasons a listen, but for now, KFAI proudly presents the Miniculture podcast, Season 7, Episode 3, Artifact or Artifice? The Kensington Runestone Hoax.
Welcome to the Mini Culture Podcast, a show that explores the untold stories of Minnesota's past and present. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. In 1898, a farmer dug up a stone engraved with a Nordic language in a field in Kensington, Minnesota. People have been arguing about it ever since. Defenders of the stone say that it proves Nordic explorers made it to Minnesota in the year 1362. The stone's detractors point to the fact that the stone is obviously a hoax. And yet, after multiple rounds of debunking, the lore of the stone persists. What's behind this unwavering belief? What do we gain when we lean on folk archaeology? Or, more importantly, what do we lose? KFAI's Matthew Schneeman explores these ideas and more.
Most people visit Alexandria, Minnesota for their lakes, over 350 according to the city's website. But when you drive into town, what you might notice first is not references to water skiing or canoeing, but Vikings.
Okay, we just rolled into Alexandria. I want to count how many things are named after Vikings.
This is Viking Plaza.
Viking Bank.
The Viking references aren't just to the region's Scandinavian heritage, but Viking history. Not far from here is where the infamous Kensington Runestone was found. Named after the small neighboring city of Kensington, Minnesota, the stone now rests in the county seat of Alexandria at the Runestone Museum.
You think it's legit or not?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here.
Yeah, I guess that's what I learned reading in the history books.
No idea. Don't even care.
It's possible that they could have come here.
I think they think it's real.
What do you think?
Haven't researched it enough to give an answer, I guess.
I just don't know that I'm sold on the idea that they came all the way here.
The Kensington Runestone. In a sentence, a stone was found that showed Nordic explorers made it to Minnesota in the 1300s. At least that's the takeaway you're meant to get when you visit the Runestone Museum.
Hi.
In the museum, there's a delightfully dated 1990s video recreation of the discovery.
Okay.
Music began and the title appeared on the screen.
This is it, the legacy of the Kensington Runestone.
Today, we're going to talk about that legacy.
But did the Vikings penetrate the heart of the continent? Did they continue their westward march?
The runestone is a thing, but it's also an idea. The thing has been debated for over 120 years, but the idea, not so much.
To these questions.
It's an incredible story. On the stone it is written, "We are eight Goths."
We are eight Goths and 22 Norwegians.
No, Mini Culture did not commission a choir to sing the inscription of the runestone. It already existed. History Theater debuted in May of 2020. Runestone, a rock musical. But before we get to that, let's finish what it says on the stone. Basically, a group of us Norsemen were out here exploring, and one day, while we were fishing,
we were out and fished one day.
We found 10 of our compatriots dead. Dear Lord, save us from evil. It's some intense stuff, and would make a good play. I was able to interview Mark Jensen, who wrote the book and co-wrote the lyrics for
Runestone the Rock Musical.
You know how long it took for me to realize there was a pun in the title?
Well, we have to credit Ron Peluso, the director, artistic director of the History Theater, for coming up with that.
I was excited to interview him and prepped a little untraditionally.
We're starting off with my surprise.
Oh, your surprise?
See the stone, come on, and Kensington.
It's quite the thing to see. Cool. Yeah, that's one of our big songs.
Mark grew up in Kensington and has been formally thinking about this story for decades, reading all about it and interviewing locals with ties to the original people involved, like his grandpa.
I actually lived about 2.5 miles away from where the runestone was found. And so my grandfather knew Olaf when he was a young farmer. Olaf was an older farmer. So he always said Olaf was honest. But my dad, he thought it was a hoax. So the joke has always been that I came from a mixed marriage because my mom thought it was real and my dad thought it was a hoax.
Now let's do the timeline. It's a wild ride, and I understand why Mark wanted to dramatize it.
It was discovered in August of 1898.
By farmer Olaf Ullmann. His young son actually found it while they were clearing a field. So the story goes, of course. It gets put on display at a bank in Kensington, and word gets around.
Meanwhile, it is a sensation. I mean, there is actually little blurbs about the runestone all over the world.
But then the academics weigh in and give it varying degrees of a thumbs down, including from a head runologist at a university in Norway.
And he looked at this and said, what's going on? And so immediately, he dismissed it as a hoax and said, he asked this farmer how he carved it.
And then it's all over. Thanks for listening. I'm Matthew Schnaim, and this has been KFAI's Mini Culture. Just kidding. The story continues. But for the time being, it's all over, which may have been a welcomed relief, to Olaf at least.
The kids were being teased. Edward got accused of sharpening the chisels. I mean,
Edward, Olaf's son, who was just a kid at the time.
You know, there's a lot more hurt going on into this story than people realize.
And so Olaf goes on with his life. He put the stone away.
So anyway, it sat in his granary for 12 years.
Until a man named Hjalmar Holand shows up.
He was writing a book about the history of the Norwegian immigrants that came to West Central Minnesota. And of course, they said, well, you got to look at the stone. So anyway, they have this scene in the musical, and he sees the stone. He's convinced it's real and offers to buy it from him. We don't
for
really...
$5.
Yes. $5. You heard that song. It's all that I've got. But my stone, it
is worth so much more. $5. Olaf will later say he only lent the stone to Holand. Not the first time the family will be misled by outsiders. Holand then takes the stone on a world tour to get it some legitimacy. And he does, but he also gets a lot of detractors. But to the detractors' chagrin, Holand popularizes the runestone. It makes it to our state capital, and eventually...
The high point of the stone, though, was it was on display at the Smithsonian Institute from 1948 to 1949.
With this new attention and legitimacy comes higher scrutiny, and a drama worth making a musical about unfolds. But I'll condense the story here. Holand attracts a nemesis of sorts who, with others, finds new evidence that makes Olaf look like he in fact planted the runestone as a hoax with the help of an accomplice. Mark doesn't ignore that evidence, but he argues that it was out of character for Olaf to have carved the stone. Perhaps it was a hoax, but planted by someone else.
Either it's a hoax Olaf carved, it's a hoax that he found, or it is what the stone says it is. So those are the three realities. I think the least likely is that Olaf carved it.
Regardless, it looks like the Kensington runestone is debunked. But it keeps on surviving. Even in the modern era, I wouldn't say damning, but embarrassing things have happened to discredit the runestone. Let's finish the timeline. In 1985, I'm born. Pause for applause. A couple grad students. Some grad students, as a joke, make their own runestone, and they plant it in a field, a slough, close to where the original runestone was found. Then, in 2001, it's discovered, and runestone advocates get excited and they claim they found further proof that the runestone is legit. The grad students, now professors, come clean and reveal their hoax. What do you say to the fact that the Runestone Museum endorsed it without being open to the idea that it was a hoax?
Well, again, you find something that helps validate it. I mean, people are going to be excited about it.
Yeah. Don't have the same standards as like...
Well, it's... Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? At this point in time, the stone had stopped being a debatable artifact and had turned into an idea, a symbol, a really big symbol. Here I am underneath Big Ollie. Across the street from the Runestone Museum in Alexandria stands a 28-foot tall, over 7,000-pound sculpture of a Viking named Big Ollie. It says he's 28 feet tall, but when you look up, all you know is he's just a big guy. In 1968, after the stone had been debunked for most, Big Ollie was sent to accompany the runestone to the Minnesota building at the World's Fair in Chicago. On Big Ollie's shield bore the phrase, "Birthplace of America," a troubling statement because it associates America not with the formation of the U.S. government, but the arrival of Europeans. In that context, the runestone can symbolize something dark. But for Mark, it's about his community and defending it.
You have all these people that come to Kensington and they layer all these other things on my community. And it's been a tough time for a lot of people when those kinds of things happen.
For John Mulholland, it was just about legitimizing the larger Scandinavian community. Even those grad students thought they were sticking up for science, a scientific community. Everyone thought they were in the right. But in all this back and forth, people lost track of another community, the ones already here. Could you introduce yourself, just name and title?
Sure. I am Samantha Odegaard. I'm from the Upper Sioux community near Granite Falls, Minnesota, and currently I work as the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer.
A Tribal Historic Preservation Officer is a consultant who is called in whenever a federally funded project is proposed on Native homeland. We've spent about 10 minutes, or 120 years, depending on when you start counting, debating the veracity of one artifact. One artifact found in an area bursting with Native history and burial grounds and actual artifacts. I wanted to talk to her about how it seemed like, in the runestone story, Native history was sidestepped. She said it was worse than that, that it was often denied. Specifically, I'm referring to Native burial sites.
One of the things that happened with part of dehumanizing and disconnecting Dakota people from the land is pushing this concept that these sites, they weren't ours. And part of that is disconnecting us from the thousands of burial mounds that were visible across the entire state or across the region.
One prominent example of this is Indian Mounds Park in St. Paul. The name may be changed to something more appropriate in the future.
Even up until the last couple of years, some of the public information, the signage, would still follow that belief that these mound builders from 2,000 years ago are not the Dakota people or their ancestors, that it was more advanced. That term is actually used, that it was more and a more advanced group of people. They're too sophisticated or too knowledgeable to have been the Dakota people that they were seeing today.
This may sound familiar. In Cambodia, it was denied that Angkor Wat was made by the Khmer people, or more famously and ridiculous, that aliens made the pyramids instead of Egyptians. Our local example is a little less dramatic, but in the same family. Samantha told me about how when the Twin Cities were being settled, military artist Seth Eastman painted the Dakota people using the mounds.
The image that you're referencing is Seth Eastman's drawing or painting of the village of Kaposia, which is no term destiny, made me think of, you know, the widely known idea of manifest destiny that was a strong belief within American history. And there's a painting that refers to it of this like angel figure in glowing white and bringing blight and infrastructure and settlers across America heading west.
And the figure is like really big, right?
Yep, she's really
like,
big.
Almost like a giant?
Yep, She has like the railroads and everything coming behind of her, and in front of her it's dark and you have the Native people are riding off and the buffalo are being chased away. That reminders of that and this idea that people have this God-given right to someone else's home, someone else's ancestral lands.
What does manifest destiny actually look like? In 1860, there were 172,000 people in Minnesota. By 1910, there were 2 million. With one-fourth of the population being foreign-born. Alexandria was founded in 1858, though abandoned in 1862 during the Dakota War, an uprising that was the result of forced relocation and the starvation of the Dakota people. After this war, many Native people were pushed further out of Minnesota, and white settlers came rushing back to Alexandria. This was helped by the security of a U.S. Army stockade that was in place till 1866. Not to mention the Homestead Act coming into full swing. It was in this context that Alexandria grew as a city. Lakes that once were chosen as a sacred place to bury someone were now beautiful places to build houses. and many people were dug up in that process. It's easy to look at the history and denounce our actions, our being white Minnesotans. But as frustrating as it may sound, today Alexandria is just a growing town trying to draw in business, which is ultimately why the runestone is still a thing. And that may sound frustrating to Native people whose ancestral homeland is there, but that's exactly how it should sound. And unfortunately, Alexandria's historical context isn't unique. I talked with Thalen Zimmerman, a reporter for Echo Press, who grew up in Kensington and lives in Alexandria. I asked him what he noticed as a reporter, opposed to just growing up there.
You know, if there's a new business that pops up, you know, people on the outside will see that and be like, oh, it's a new business. But someone, from my perspective, I mean, it's been reported on, or it's been, people have been looking into it and interviewing people involved in it. I think walking down the street, I could see more of that. I can see or understand the decision process, that how that got there.
And one thing that helps open these new businesses, helps Alexandria grow, is tourism.
Thinking of the museum as something that's important to bring tourism, it makes me feel kind of different about attacking them for essentially promoting a hoax. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, yeah.
I understand it. Like, mm-hmm. it's important to the city.
I should add, the museum is not run by the city.
Even though I may think it's kind of, yeah. I don't know, ethically murky.
I'd say definitely. I mean, I don't know the numbers on it, but the tourism plays a huge part of it.
It's hard to blame Alexandria for leaning into their Viking iconography. A town doesn't really get to pick what they're going to be known for. I doubt Austin, Minnesota would have picked Spam as a tourist attraction. But like Spam, the context and history behind the runestone is important. Spam came from U.S. military jingoism. The runestone, what does it mean? Well, it means something to a lot of us. It fills a gap in the white Minnesotan backstory. I happen to think this is bad. But Mark, writer of Runestone, a rock musical, he sees it more positively.
What I think people are missing here is you have immigrants coming here to the U.S. and they're trying to establish an identity here in the U.S., much like immigrants are today. So I think if it's a hoax, it's about saying, hey, we belong here. Okay, we belong here. It's not about, you know, we got to be careful of putting a modern spin on what you're saying there with race. I think it's more about, we're immigrants, we want to be a part of this country.
Yeah, but I mean, not a modern spin. In 1898, that's not too many years away from the Dakota War. That's during reservations.
Again,
mm-hmm. I mean, the we belong here, I think, it's a beautiful thing, but also it was an awful thing, the presumption that we belong here to do whatever we want.
Oh, I don't think, no. I think you're taking it too far. I don't think it's that at all.
Well, I mean, it's true that there's a museum for the runestone, but like in the native section, they have some like moccasins and stuff, but they don't have stuff on Douglas County and how Alexandria didn't become a big town until they had a military outpost put there, you know. The museum may have included that history, but it wasn't front and center. Also, the Runestone Museum declined an interview for this piece.
We have to become more sensitive to what has created America. And my point is, if it is a hoax, it's not about imperialism. It's about a group of people, you know, wanting to be a part of this country. And it's not taking it any further than really that.
Mark told me the stone is like a mirror. It reflects back to you what you want to see. I see something dark in it, but he sees something quite beautiful.
Growing up in Kensington, it was about Olaf and defending him and that he was an honest man. That's the crux of it for me.
How do you close the musical with Olaf's story?
You know, the different people accusing you of things, the different theories all get dramatized until we get to the end, where what is this? We don't know what it is. Who do you think I am?
Who do you think I am?
Who do you think I am? Am I a crook?
Am I your sheer genius who carved a spiteful lie because you wanted to confound?
Am I a bumpkin?
Who do you think I am?
Am I an honest man?
A simple, sweet bumpkin, no smarter than his shoe, who pulled a runestone from the ground.
Can we end on that? That's the question.
I can be the man who fits your theory, even though I grow so very, very weary of your endless questions.
Before, I was just like, this is silly. These Alexandrians are like, what the hell? How can you have a big sculpture that says Birthplace of America? But now I'm a little bit more understanding of just kind of the hustle a small town has to do. So that's just kind of what I'm working through right now. What comes to mind when you hear me speak that rationalization?
Samantha Odegaard, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer.
You know, I try to be a very level-headed type person that thinks about things and understand things. So in that concept, I can understand it. People are looking for a way to connect and have a sense of pride in who they are or where they're from. But it is difficult to hear. It is annoying, or at the very least, or in some ways it's something that angers me, depending on my mood of the day. Mm. And I don't know if this will be a good thing to say on there, but also I pity them in a way, that they have to search so hard for some sense of connection.
Made me think of that video that was shown at the Kensington Runestone Museum.
Touch the hidden past, still only partially understood.
They have to work so hard to try to
feel it.
Make their home or their where they're living and their town relevant.
Yep. We have our own legacy to prove it. With the Kensington Runestone.
How do I connect with, you know, I am a Minnesotan, without erasing Native history? It's kind of a riddle that we haven't been taught as white people to solve.
And I don't know if I have the answer to that.
No. Here it is.
200 pounds. I suppose it's my riddle to solve. When I went to the Kensington Runestone Museum, I had this odd feeling. Even though I thought the stone was a fake, it still had this incredible historical value to me.
Like, it's more meaningful as a hoax than as an actual artifact. Because if it's an actual artifact, that means that in 1300 some Vikings kind of like stopped by, got in a fight.
But as a hoax, it explains a lot. How we believe, what makes us comfortable and pass over the bad bits. Things like why we love Paul Bunyan, even though he chopped down almost all of our old growth pine forests. How Caribou Coffee was founded here, don't you know?
But
caribou have left Minnesota due to habitat loss. How we're proud of Charles Lindbergh up until he embraces the Third Reich in 1938. The hoax explains why Minnesota pride, to me, often feels a bit saccharine. The Kensington Runestone gives my people a reason for being here. Olaf Oman dug up that stone in a field in 1898. But he wasn't the only one looking for it. And it certainly wasn't the only thing there. For KFAI, I'm Matthew Schneeman. Music for this piece was done by Dawview and me. Thanks to Gary Rue for supplying demos from Runestone, a rock musical, to us. Proper recorded versions of those songs will be coming out later this year.
Thank you. Support for Mini Culture on KFAI has been provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Season 7 of the Mini Culture Podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sensulo. New episodes coming soon, so subscribe to Mini Culture wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, John Gibertatios, and thanks for listening.
KFAI is proud to present the 12th annual Landmark Live Concert and Cocktail Series, featuring top folk, blues, and roots artists. It takes place every third Friday of each month, September through December, at St. Paul's historic Landmark Center. Performing on Friday, September 15th, Eric Peltonimi and Dean McGraw. Eric Peltonimi is excited to team with his friend and renowned guitarist Dean McGraw, bringing a fresh batch of new songs and reimagined early ones to this Landmark Center 2023 Fall Concert Series. Tickets for the Landmark Live Concert Series can be found at the Landmark Center website. Visit www.landmarkcenter.org.
You are listening to Mini Culture Presents, KFAI's sound and documentary showcase program. My name is Michael Whetstone, and today here on Mini Culture Presents, we are listening to a pair of episodes from Season 7 of the Mini Culture Podcast. I'm pleased to play them on the air, but you can also find them in your feed wherever you like to listen to podcasts, if you subscribe. You can also visit KFAI.org and hit the Mini Culture tab, and you can stay on top of everything these talented producers are doing at Miniculture's SoundCloud page. You'll find buckets of terrific arts, history, and culture stories about our great state there on their SoundCloud page. And you can easily share them with your friends from there, too. If you'd like to help keep these very vital and hyper-local stories on the air, consider making a pledge today to Miniculture's radio home, KFEI. KFEI relies on your financial support. This is a real community, a truly people-powered public radio. Please make a difference and a donation today at KFAI.org. Thank you. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members and also the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Radio without boundaries. Support for Mini Culture.
Was in the 1880s relied on subscriptions or per copy sales and needed to appeal to a wide range of readers, including working people. Labor unions had a huge social component, and Minneapolis and St. Paul both had very active labor communities.
John McDonald is asked by John Swift, who's the editor of the St. Paul Globe, if his daughter, who by then is actually working as a printer, if she would be interested in writing stories for the newspaper.
Eva immediately accepted. This is an excerpt from the first Eva Gay column, March 25th, 1888, Among Girls Who Toil.
I propose to carry Globe readers with me through a series of articles and show the life, home life, and shop life of the working girls and women of Minneapolis. Every morning, the streetcars and thoroughfares of the city are thronged with busy crowds of breadwinners. Even a careless observer will note that a large proportion of the crowd are women, some of them comfortably dressed, showing in their faces no signs of hardship, others hurrying along, their scanty dress, stooping shoulders, and pale faces showing that for them, the struggle for a living is a hard fight.
Eva was not alone in her efforts. She was one of a growing number of American women in journalism.
So we start in 1840 with Margaret Fuller.
Here's Brooke Kroger, professor and author of a number of books on the history of journalism. Kroger places Margaret Fuller as one of the earliest American women journalists.
She's a genius. She's a scholar. She's an incredible networker. She decides she's going to cover the city, especially the underclasses. And she's particularly interested in women prostitutes, things like that.
Women were able to write outside the confines of the so-called women's realms of homemaking, family, and material goods by writing for alternative publications, like the abolitionist press. Since women were deeply involved with that movement, it was an important step towards emerging women's suffrage. By the latter half of the 19th century, women were able to write for major newspapers as travel correspondents.
So that's where we see this start.
In the 1880s comes a woman who would define the archetype of stunt girl reporter, Nellie Bly. While she didn't invent sensational investigative journalism, she made the technique a popular and lucrative niche.
Nellie is the first we know about who started doing this undercover work.
Nellie Bly caused a sensation when she checked herself in, undercover, as a patient at a notorious mental asylum, and wrote a lengthy expose.
So she just immediately becomes a celebrity. She's looking into the baby buying trade. She's seeing what's happening with prison matrons if a woman gets arrested. She's going to centers for women who are down on their luck or who are alcoholic, exposing mesmerists. I mean, just all sorts of things, week after week after week after week.
In addition to being published in the widely read New York World, Bly's exposés were published in book form. As Eva Valesh became Eva Gay, writers across the country took this formula and wrote their own sensational spins on it, usually under a nom de plume.
And not just Eva, but in Chicago, Nell Nelson. In Colorado, there was Polly Pry. It was great for business. People were fascinated by this you can believe me character who was telling you things that she had experienced.
According to Dr. Pfau, Eva wanted people to understand the lives and conditions of working women by asking these fundamental questions.
Who are the women workers? What are the conditions of women workers? What do they get paid? What is their life like beyond the workplace? What are relations like in the workplace for women? One must understand this is in a wider society in which women were seen to be subordinate, lesser, and having little to no political rights.
Most of the industries Eva investigated were in downtown Minneapolis, near the river. Here she is describing the women in a garment factory.
Standing near the elevator door, listening to and watching the busy scene before me, I found myself breathing an atmosphere whose distinguishing characteristics were a smell of new cloth, dust, heat, and sewer gas. It was stifling. There was a row of large windows along two sides of the room. Noticing several girls with bandaged heads and complaining of headache, I asked why they didn't open the windows and get some fresh air. One said, "We can't stand it to have open the windows in this weather. We get such colds and rheumatiz from the draft."
Dr. Pfau tells us about Eva and John Swift, the editor of the St. Paul Globe.
John Swift hires her to go as an undercover reporter to the various different workshops in the city to cover what was by then a kind of new phenomena, which is a growing number of single women workers in a city.
A general inquiry showed that the majority of the girls had to support themselves, paying from $2 to $3 a week for board and lodging, having, of course, to make what was left after that due for dress and other expenses.
Typical wages Eva encounters range from $3 to $7 a week. $3 in 1888 would be about $95 a week today. That's about $1.50 an hour in 2022. Eva's involvement with the Knights of Labor gave her a strong understanding of labor and politics. By writing about the lives of women workers, Eva was not only telling stories and selling papers, she was promoting the political interests of organized labor in a popular and accessible way.
Labor journalism and this kind of intensive investigation of women, or just in general of workers, was one of the ways in which labor politics could connect beyond its small ranks, could make it clear that there were political stakes to this kind of economy, that could talk about the role of the workers in that economy, but also sort of see them as part of a whole.
April 1st, 1888, The Toiling Women. I brushed off the dust and went over to Bemis Brothers on 3rd Avenue near 3rd Street. They don't seem to care for visitors. No hands wanted is a sign near the entrance door. A little farther on, at the foot of the stairs, is the sign, "No admission upstairs, all business transacted at the office." I hadn't any business to transact, so skipped upstairs and found the factory, large, well-lighted, and heated by steam. It seemed as clean as such a place well could be. Apparently, about 75 girls were employed, some sewing different sorts of sacks, some clipping the sacks apart as they came from the machine, others standing at the folding machines where the sacks were turned after sewing. The girls who worked at these folding machines were obliged to stand all day, and it seemed to be wearisome work. The girls were dressed with the same regard to convenience rather than style, which was noted at the other factory. The dust was not as bad in this place, except where the burlap sacks were handled. Several girls had severe coughs.
Dressed in shabby, unassuming clothes, Eva would either sneak into a business in disguise, or she would apply and fabricate her references. It was vital that she experience the workers' world unvarnished.
The first place she enters is the one that actually brings her to fame. The shop she enters is called Shotwell Clarihue and Loffman. There's probably about 300 women employed. The only men who are employed are not doing garment manufacture. And those male workers tend to be supervisors or clerks. But they are seen to be of a relatively privileged position within that workplace. The dude clerks and the supervisor are not the friends of women.
If your foreman insults you, why don't you complain to the proprietors? What's the use? If we don't want to put up with the way we're treated, we are told we can leave. They can find plenty, glad to get a chance to work for any wages.
In addition to the risks women workers faced by low wages, dangerous working conditions, and abusive male workers, Eva took on even more risks by going undercover. Not only was it risky as an individual, but it also put the integrity of the newspaper on the line.
Being exposed was a big risk, I think we'd have to say that. Because if you think about it, what you're doing is quite illegal. I mean, you're perpetrating a fraud. You're taking up a place of someone who might really need it. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to get yourself quashed legally. And I imagine a good editor anywhere else would have taken those kinds of precautions.
Eva was taking these risks to humanize and empower the workers.
So after she gets done with doing the column on women garment workers, she starts to go off and have other adventures. But in the midst of it, she winds up being drawn into and being drawn back to the Shotwell Clarihue and Loffman factory, which has gone out on strike.
Tensions in the factory had finally broken. Eva returned to find out more, referring to the women as striking maidens in her subsequent column from April 29th, 1888. Here's Dr. Pfau.
It's very clear that things have been changing in the factory. They could sing before, now they can't sing. They have a new foreman who's very hard on them, who physically threatens them, who verbally abuses them, but also made a drastic wage cut.
Eva and the workers went straight to the Knights of Labor Hall to hold their first meeting. They formulated demands for better wages and conditions, and they discussed strategies for moving forward.
I had never seen a meeting of working girls before, my acquaintance being confined to the workshop. I was wondering if there wouldn't be the amount of confusion and sharp retort, which is always credited to women's meetings when they have no masculine hand at the helm to keep order. There was, however, good order, but the girls were more willing and eager to talk than I have found them in my visits to their factories. What is a boycott? I asked. The girls laughed. Well, Eva, you are a bright one not to know that, they said. When the laugh subsided, one said, you see, the trade of Shotwell, Clarihue, and Loffman is heavy in the city. Now, the goods they handle are those worn by the laboring classes. We can, by the united aid of organized labor, make those goods so unpopular that there would be no sale for them.
The strike was on for a few weeks, but had unintended consequences, and ultimately the company went bankrupt. The women were left without pay and without work. Eva kept up the column until about 1890. In a series from 1889, she is fired from her position as a lady's maid when she failed to keep her mistress's afternoon opium party a secret from a pug dog and a prudish aunt.
February 24th, 1889, and so she flunked. I feel melancholy too. Miss Clara wouldn't listen to my excuses and has discharged me. She will be chaperoned by her aunt in future. Again, I must seek a new field of activity. My occupation is gone.
Eva Gay tried other kinds of work as a cashier, a clerk, bookbinder. She worked in hotels and resorts. She tried the latest fads. But eventually, she moved towards general reporting before getting married and leaving the Globe altogether. She kept writing, kept championing working women. Labor stayed her focus, but she never returned to her investigative roots. Brooke Kroger charts the demise of the stunt girl reporter fad after just a few years.
Was it good for women in journalism? For a while and for a few, because it took a certain kind of woman who could do this. It was a form that very quickly lost its appeal. So we have it happening from 1887 till about, like, really petering out in the early 1890s. And just from overexposure, from too often use, like, how many things can you come up with?
Eva Valesh might not have originated her method of undercover investigation, but she certainly made the most she could of it by trying to help others while it lasted.
Since the 1970s, undercover reporting has carried a stigma. If you look through the records of the Pulitzer Prizes, up until the mid-1970s, there are repeated prizes, especially in local specialized investigative reporting. It used to be a category, looking at voting patterns or looking at hospitals or looking at abortion clinics.
For newspapers facing declines in readership, undercover investigation was the public sacrifice for a newspaper industry set on earning the trust of its readers. Again, Brooke Kroger.
It involved some questionable techniques, which of course undercover reporting always does. You know, it's something that puts a knot in your stomach because it isn't entirely above board. And yet it achieves at its best some remarkable and fantastic effects.
In this excerpt from April 22, 1888, Eva Gay's Travels, Eva succinctly appealed to her readers with a simple admonition to businesses that she investigated.
The strike at the Overall factory this week has shown the public that my statements in that case were not only true, but many other facts could have been told. It is about the same in regard to Langley and Johnson and many other firms that feel aggrieved. Let them treat their employees fairly and justly. There will then be no work for me to do.
In a short time, Eva brought much attention to conditions of working women in the Twin Cities. She gave a voice to the disempowered, but even more importantly, she listened.
She lived so outside the boundaries of her time, so counter to what women were supposed to do. She doesn't see that there's a big divide between being a labor intellectual, a journalist, and being an organizer and an advocate. That there's, for her, these are missions that are combined.
As it came time to go home, one of the girls said to me, "Now you will get caught." "Why?" I asked. "Because the overseer stands at the door to see that the girls don't carry the factory home. So you will get your notebook looked over." I watched my opportunity, and while he was examining some of the bundles, slid past and joyfully made my escape. Eva Gay.
For KFAI, I'm Ben Heath.
Special thanks to Lindsay Fenner for reading the parts of Eva Valesh. Dr. Elizabeth Fowle is the author of Righting the Wrongs, Eva Valesh and the Rise of Labor Journalism. Brooke Kroger's latest book, Undaunted, How Women Changed American Journalism, comes out in May 2023. Music in today's episode is by Alice J. Shaw, remastered by Canary Records. Support for Miniculture on KFAI has been provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Season 7 of the Miniculture Podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sensulo. New episodes coming soon, so subscribe to Miniculture wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, John Gibertatios, and thanks for listening.
You have been tuned into Miniculture Presents here on KFEI. Today's program focused on two episodes from Season 7 of KFEI's very own Miniculture Podcast. You can also find it at KFEI.org under the Miniculture tab. This is Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support for Miniculture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Thanks for tuning in. Coming up next, Upside Down.
Donate your used car to KFAI. We pick it up for free. You get a tax-deductible donation that supports great community radio because it's Car-tober.
Okay, but what about trucks?
Fine, it's car and truck-tober.
And boats?
Car, truck, and boat-tober.
Motorcycles?
Car, truck, boat, and motorbike-tober.
And trailers?
Car, truck, boat, motorbike, and tow-tober.
Actually, we'll take lots of vehicle donations. Just go to kfai.careasy.org for more information.
Car, truck, boat, motorbike, tow, and snowmotober.
KFAI is proud to present Theon Cross at the Dakota on Thursday, November 2nd. Theon Cross's unique approach to the tuba has reinvented the instrument's place in modern music. As a core member of the Sons of Kemet, the flexibility and power of his sound has made Theon an indispensable presence across the length and breadth of the current UK jazz scene. His most recent album, Intra I, an exploratory and uplifting celebration of the Afro-diaspora music, examining self-development, the importance of history and heritage, and the strength in adversity. Opening the show is local electronic artist, Dosh. Tickets for Theon Cross can be found at the Dakota website. Visit dakotacooks.com for more details.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, and around the world at kfai.org. This is Upside Down.